You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Texas is taking action to remove certain books from its school libraries, but is any push to ban books bound to backfire? We'll hear from three authors who have faced book bans themselves. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, there's been a lot of criticism of social media platforms lately and the impact they have on our personal well-being and on society at large. Our next guest says a lot of the solutions offered don't get at a basic problem with social media. It's too big. Social media platforms allow us to say as much as we want and consume as much as we want with an unlimited audience. They encourage us to give and receive communication nonstop. And maybe our brains weren't built for that. Maybe we need smaller, slower platforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were monarch of social media for a day, what would you change? Would you try to clean up the place? How would you describe the majority of the connections or relationships you have with people on social media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ian Bogost is director of the program in Film and Media Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic. His latest book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. His recent piece in The Atlantic is called People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Can you start by talking about this concept of mega scale that you lay out in the piece that we encounter on social media?
Yes, technology companies want to be as big as possible. And this is relatively new in human civilization to have companies that service billions of customers all around the globe. And that goal of being as big as possible and reaching as many people as possible has sort of been transferred from these technology companies' business models down to the desires of their users. You want to have as many friends as you can on Facebook or as many followers on Twitter and Instagram as you can get. You want to process all that information by reading your feeds and getting your stuff out there to thousands or even millions of people every day. Not just a very large user base, as my colleague at The Atlantic, Adrian LaFrance, calls it, but an unprecedented one, one that's never been bigger in human history.
Compare that to what psychology tells us about how many relationships we're usually used to managing, close or slightly less close.
It's a lot less. And one of the examples I use in this piece is from a British psychologist named Robin Dunbar, who's famous for this idea of Dunbar's number. And that is 150. Basically, Dunbar's claim was you can have up to, at a maximum, maybe 150 productive bonds with other people. And that's where the human brain starts to shut down. It just can't have meaningful relationships beyond that. But actually, that number, even that 150 number, is big. And most of the conversations, the deep, meaningful connections you have are with a much smaller circle, about, you know, 5 to 15 family members, close friends, and so on. But even if you don't buy Dunbar's specific take, and there are a lot of people who have laid criticism in his feed about that number, I think the idea that there's a conceptual limit, a psychological or even a biological limit to the amount of relationships we can maintain while maintaining those relationships meaningfully and valuably, that does make sense.
All right. Now, if I want to scroll down Facebook or Twitter, I can encounter, consume the communication of, I don't know what, 50 different people in 1 minute. How does our brain that's looking for like 15 closies and 150 further aways or whatever the numbers are, what does that do to us when we're getting this fire hose?
Yeah, well, one thing you might notice if you think about the experience you have on social media is that you tend to be less empathetic or to think less about that there's a person on the other end of that conversation. Instead, it turns into an opponent or an enemy or maybe someone you want to align with. And so we kind of transform those connections with other people into resources that we can use to advance our agendas or to confirm our existing beliefs or to reject or react to beliefs that we don't have. In general, we instrumentalize those people and we take the material and kind of ratchet up conflict around it.
We're talking to Ian Bogost about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic, People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much, about social media, how much we consume, how it may be too much for us, and we'll get to this in a bit, maybe different ways to think about how to design and control our interactions on social media in a healthier way. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself scrolling and scrolling on whichever your social media of choice is? Does it all blur together? Does it flatten out your relationships with people? Do you think there's a better way? Is the better way turning it off for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to other possible models, Ian, something that really struck me about your piece is, you know, those close people, whatever the number is, 10, 15, 20, we build that over time. And then we might rely on those people more. It really can flatten it out if we just have this flood of people. And you worry that's one of the things that might steer people into, say, a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, one of the things that happens online is everybody kind of looks the same. You know, literally, their profiles look the same as one another. If you bring up someone's Facebook page or their Instagram or Twitter profile, they appear to you the same way that a stranger does. Whereas, you know, when you recognize, you know, a close friend or a family member, all of that sort of meaning that's been built up over many years in that relationship, the reason that you trust those people and that you're willing to take their advice or hear what they have to say and process it based on your past experiences, that takes a long time to establish and you're able to recognize it. But when we have all of these sort of skin deep, constant, small scale interactions with lots of random people and lots of people maybe that you know, but you're not engaging with in that deep, close way that builds further trust, then we're more susceptible to taking their word for things, right? That we treat them as trustworthy interlocutors prematurely.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Verona. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I don't use social media to connect with my friends or family more, but to get gardening tips and knitting tips and cross stitch because I don't have anyone life that does it, so it's another way for me to connect to those that enjoy the hobbies I do.
And you restrict your social media use to those interest groups, Elizabeth? That practical stuff?
No, I still have friends and family on my newsfeed for Facebook, but I don't see them. Mm. Like, my whole newsfeed is covered in knitting and cross stitch and design ideas.
I love it. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Ian, you talk about some of that in your piece, defining our circles on social media.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you narrow the community that you're interacting with or that can interact with you, one of the things that it does is it allows you to understand and process that information in a more productive way. One way to do that is through common interests. And in fact, you know, communities and message boards around hobbies like knitting, as Elizabeth spoke of, those have been around for a long time online, and they're some of the most productive and healthy communities, or at least they can be, because people know what they're going in for, right? You go there to get knitting advice, and you know, so long as you're a little suspicious maybe of the, I don't know, the political opinions that you hear in your knitting circle, then you're okay, right? And that sense that your circles can be defined, that the software can sort of enforce a smaller community, that's something I'm very interested as a kind of design concept for social media and something that we've seen in the past but sort of abandoned.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Ian, that takes us to a model maybe that didn't survive. Google, was it Plus?
Google Plus, yeah. Google Plus was Google's attempt to make a social network akin to Facebook, which they started designing in the late aughts and rolled out in 2011 or so. And one of the things that some of the designers, including a designer named Paul Adams, who wrote a book about this concept later on, one of the things they looked at was research such as Dunbar's and others that were, you know, looking at the way that sociologists and psychologists establish the kinds of connections we have and what makes them productive. And so on Google Plus, this is a small thing, but a really interesting example of a way of kind of designing this constraint into your online social interactions. They made you, as a user, organize your friends or family into these things they called circles. And that made you kind of go, well, what kind of person is this to me? Is this a family member that I want to share all of my intimate details with? Is this a coworker that I have a different relationship with? Is this one of my knitting friends, you know, that I have yet a different relationship with? And by creating a structure in the service itself that enforced those boundaries, it helped. But over time, you know, we stopped doing that because it didn't produce as much engagement in the software. And of course, Google Plus, the fact that you may not have heard of it before, tells you how that story ended.
Talking to Ian Bogost, Program Director in Film and Media Studies at Washington University, author of the book Play Anything. Talk about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic on social media. It may just be too big. We may be interacting with too many people in the same way at the same time. He says we should try some different models. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with social media? Is there a particular thing you do online that you feel like is a good, healthy form of communication? Are there things that struck you as toxic? Maybe you stopped doing them, scrolling through whatever the feed might be. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ian Bogost from Washington University, author of the book Play Anything, talking about a piece of his in The Atlantic, exploring what happens to our relationships as humans when we connect with maybe too many other humans on social media platforms. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Is there a better way, you think, to use social media? How have you controlled the way you use social media? Or is the best way? No way. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Janesville. Michelle, hello.
Hi. So I just want to give a shout out to all of the people who do not use Facebook. Way back in the day when Facebook first came out, and I was very overwhelmed with having to check a personal email and then a work email. And then all my friends were saying, Facebook, Facebook. And I said, oh, I think it's too much for me. I don't think I can manage all of these things. And so I never, ever got a Facebook account. And my husband and I thought we were the last people on earth who were not on Facebook until all of a sudden, all of our couple friends are not on Facebook. So we actually get together for dinners and board game nights, and we have face-to-face groups, not Facebook groups.
I love it, Michelle. And it sounds to me like you feel pretty good about that decision.
I feel great about it. I just hear all the drama and all the other things that people talk about Facebook, and I'm really glad that I never did sign up.
All right, I'm a board game fan, Michelle, so you can invite me over sometime maybe. But Ian, that is an option. We can abdicate from the social media system.
It's definitely an option, and you know, as Michelle's story indicates, it's an option that some people don't feel like they're missing out on anything by pursuing. But it's harder than it seems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not Facebook. You know, Facebook used to be extremely popular with all sorts of communities. Now younger people tend not to use Facebook. They're using Instagram and Snapchat and other services. And there's kind of this, you know, this joke about Facebook having become a social network for boomers, which isn't quite right because they've got billions of users worldwide. But the point I would make here is that it is becoming a luxury to be able to opt out from these systems. They are in large part, or at least in some part, where life happens today. And when you sign out of Facebook or when you close your account, as many people have done in the past number of years, you do miss something. And if you were never there, you might not know that you're missing it. But you know, you stop seeing those stories from your friends or your colleagues. You lose touch with people. And then there's other kinds of services like, you know, like LinkedIn or what have you, where professional life and recruitment and job opportunities can arise. So I think for a lot of people who aren't ready to take the plunge, like Michelle is, they're aware of this kind of palpable feeling that they would be missing out on something without these services. And that's why companies like Facebook have tried to present their services as almost like utilities that everybody needs just to get by in the contemporary world.
Michelle, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Ian, you mentioned with Google Plus, which you saw as maybe a healthier model, it declined because of a lack of engagement. Can you talk about the incentive structure that I think pretty much all social media companies have had to boost engagement at all costs?
Yeah, growth all the time, and growth in all manner of ways. Adding more users, getting those users to interact with the service more often, making those interactions more emotionally amped up, because that tends to draw out more additional participation, comments, and reactions. And of course, all of these things are done in order that that engagement can be used as a basis to sell advertising against, which is where Facebook and Google and most of these companies make all their money. So it's mega scale in every way. The total number of users and all of the frequency with which those users are interacting, the amount of material they produce, the acceleration of that material into the hands and fingertips of others. That's where the incentives lie. And you can see why Google Plus, which shut down, was working, you know, a little bit against the grain there. By limiting the way that your posts could get access to other people, that would reduce engagement. So, you know, Facebook took over the mantle of social media right at a time when it decided to amplify as much as it could to as many people as it could, which is, you know, kind of where all the problems started in my mind.
Talking to Ian Bogost about his piece in The Atlantic on social media, the overwhelming mega scale and what it does to our relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ian, you think we could do a lot better on social media if we have some, I don't know, breaks or limits or things like that. What kind of experiments would you like to see where constraint might make things better?
Yeah, the simple idea is if this mega scale thing is the problem, then downscale has to be the solution. It's just become almost impossible to think about downscaling social media at all because that's not what it is. That's not what it's become, and that's certainly not where the incentives lie for the companies that run them. So if you think about a platform like Twitter, where you can post as much as you want to as many people as you can find, those posts are constrained. They're limited. There's only a certain number of characters in an individual post. And of course, you could write as many as you want in a day. But that idea of a constraint on Twitter, 280 characters worth of text, that's something that we, when we engage with it, we appreciate. We don't feel like, oh, I'm being prohibited from saying what I want. It's like, how can I get the thing I want to say into this small, pithy remark? And what that tells me is that people are ready to embrace constraint. And in fact, that meaning in general comes from it, right? So imagine if those same kinds of constraints applied to the scale issue. Imagine if you just couldn't reach as many people as you could get, but it was limited to, you know, 280 people or 280 posts a day or a week or a year. Or if you could sort of time out a post. You said something and after a while it just kind of dies and vanishes, right? And some of those experiments have taken place across other platforms, but they've always been curiosities. They haven't been central to the way that people experience their use of social media. And I certainly think there's just a lot more thought and design work to be done that might be more healthy.
If my economic model as a social media company is based on working in bulk, the more data I collect from our users by them posting more stuff, the better I do. How do we change the incentive structure for the companies designing these platforms?
It's a huge problem. And in some ways, you might say, well, you can't change that incentive structure. And that's where this question of intervention and regulation maybe comes into play. There's a lot of discussion about what it might mean to break up Facebook or to regulate social media. And I think a lot of those dreams are impossible to realize. Even if you were to break up Facebook, you'd still have several different companies at mega scale, Instagram and WhatsApp, that are serving the same billions of people and encouraging them to do as much posting and as much interaction as they can. It's also difficult to measure and to kind of create equity in these constraints. Like, oh, the algorithm should be more transparent. That's a story we sometimes hear. What does that mean? And who would police it and how would we know? Whereas enforcing some kind of regulation around scale, around the number of people you can reach or the frequency, maybe it's a terrible idea, but it's at least one worth thinking about because we can imagine it downscaling the system and being enforced on these companies.
do you see room in the market for, I don't know, artisanal boutique social media platforms? I'm just making this up right now.
No, it's a great question.
To reach out to people and, go ahead.
There have been examples of this. Sometimes there are art projects where you can post to this social network 100 times and that's it in your whole life. And, yes, the problem is as long as Megascale exists beside them, it will always win. So, those kinds of artisanal platforms, they become curiosities and, maybe a few people use them. But they don't have the same sort of social and political effect that the 500-pound gorillas do.
Is there something about all these platforms being free, in quotes? You don't pay money for them. You're basically giving your data away. If we paid money for our social media platforms, would we use them in a better way, do you think?
It's a really great point. And you think about how telephones used to work. Back when you had to pay for long-distance calls. You kind of thought long and hard, do I need to call grandma this week? Or, you made a call because you needed to, and you justified it in relation to the cost you were spending. And the internet made everything free, and therefore we could do as much of it as we wanted. And we've always treated that as a net positive. And it is in many ways. But it also created this other problem, where because there's no cost to communication, we maybe do too much of it.
As we wrap up, Ian, do you have thoughts for individual users? It's going to take a lot to change the social media landscape. What do you think about as a social media user to make the experience not terrible?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is to recognize that this isn't your fault. That this idea that you have to take on the personal responsibility to intervene in your time management or in your life, I mean, that's just sort of rubbish. You can't do it. I mean, you could maybe try to opt out. But if you're participating, you are being led down the path that these companies want. So instead, see how you can tune the services that you use in the way that Elizabeth mentioned. I'm only going to use it to talk to these people. I'm going to be deliberate about reducing my friends or only talking to this community on this channel. That's one way that you can start to gain a little bit of control over the system. I think what you'll find in so doing is that those kinds of constraints are pleasurable. You don't lose anything, and in fact, you gain quite a bit from enforcing them.
Ian, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ian Bogost is a program director in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Talked to him today about a recent piece he wrote for The Atlantic looking at reigning in the megascale of social media connections. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at a landmark case against opioid makers that was just reversed this week. First, getting in to see the dentist can be a challenge for low-income patients across Wisconsin. Less than half of Wisconsin dentists accept Medicaid, and even if a patient can find a dentist, many face barriers with things like transportation, childcare, and other needs. State lawmakers have introduced some efforts to try and address the issue, but the pandemic has made it more difficult. We're learning more about the extent of the problem and resources available to people in need. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble finding a dentist? Are they few and far between in your neck of the woods? Do you lack dental insurance? Do you avoid going to the dentist because you can't afford it? Has that caused problems in your life? And if you work in the dental profession, what do you see from your side of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Ian Hedges is CEO of HealthNet of Rock County, a free and charitable clinic based in Janesville. Ian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I know this is an ongoing problem, Ian, but how much has the pandemic shaken things up when it comes to affordable dental care access?
It has shaken up the field quite a bit. So the wonderful thing is during the most recent budget rendition, both Republicans and Governor Evers increased reimbursement for Medicaid for dental services by 40%. This was long overdue, but the issue is many dentists across the state are still reeling from the COVID-19 pandemic. Many dentists lost more than 3 months of income for themselves and their offices with assistants, hygienists, and receptionists. So they then had to, and then they also had to pay for costs to upgrade their offices to deal with airflow. So there's still quite a bit of hesitancy to take patients who cannot pay the full rate of care. The other issue that remains is that we have dramatically seen that more people have gotten onto BadgerCare since the COVID-19 pandemic. So in Rock County alone, I believe before the pandemic, we had 25,500 individuals on BadgerCare. We now have 34,000. And that's come from job loss, reduced income. And that means fewer opportunities to see the dentist. And with these transitions still going on with COVID-19, I think it makes things a little bit harder, because we have to remember that BadgerCare is a piece of the social safety net that does not fully solve many of the issues for patients that utilize it. Many patients on BadgerCare kind of struggle with transportation, inflexible work schedules, or less familial support. And I think that could lead to missed appointments, which means missed opportunities for dentists to recoup their losses from the past year and a half. So all of those challenges have come up because of the pandemic.
Now, I think of dental care as one of those preventive maintenance kind of things where you can get that regular treatment, detect problems early. And if that doesn't happen because you can't afford it or whatever reason, it can be a really critical, maybe even emergency problem down the road that's going to be painful and more expensive to treat. Is that what ends up working out in the long run for people?
Yes. I mean, we see this locally in hospitals. I know that for a fact we had 400 individuals just in one hospital alone go there because they were on Medicaid and because they had an emergency dental issue. What is the most unfortunate part about this is they go to the hospital, and the hospital more than likely will not have a dentist on staff. So they are being stopped there kind of at the gates. And because medical and dental are so separate, there were four referral process for someone to come into the emergency room and then get immediately called upon to go to a dentist. Get that appointment to a dentist is often really hard. So someone gets turned away at the door, and then the oral health problem just kind of gets worse usually. Some safety net providers are working on that to address that gap, but it's still one that exists.
What kind of things are you doing there at HealthNet in Rock County when it comes to providing access to dental care?
What we're doing is we are actually doing a pilot project with our local health systems in which if a patient has Medicaid or is uninsured, comes into the emergency room, has a dental issue, and they can't treat it, they will immediately have the patients sign the intake paperwork and then fax it over to us so that we can get an appointment scheduled for them within 72 hours after that appointment. Another thing that we are trying to utilize is trying to get younger individuals in their social programs, whether they be in schools or in daycare centers. And we try to provide treatments there, detect decay. And once we detect decay, we then try to case manage in order to make sure that those young ones come into our programs at a later time. It requires a lot of calls to parents or guardians. But that's where we see a lot of decay right now is in the school systems when we go do school-based preventative work.
Talking to Ian Hedges with HealthNet of Rock County, a free and charitable clinic based in Janesville, looking at access and lack of access in some cases to dental care, to affordable dental care here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe your own experiences on either side of the tooth. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Kenosha. Chris, hello.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about the discrepancy between like quality of care between people who have like, let's say, Medicare and maybe somebody who has private dental insurance. I may be wrong, but I secondhand experience, you know, somebody who has relies on Medicare and like some restorative work isn't covered, like caps and stuff like that. But, you know, pulling a tooth is covered and they would only have to pay $3 and, you know, now, I know dental insurance plans are different, but for me, that, you know, some of that would be reimbursed. And so I wouldn't have to think about pulling a tooth instead of getting restorative work. And I was wondering if, you know, any of that has gotten worse during COVID or not.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call and the question. Ian, a different quality of care for people under Medicare coverage, Medicare coverage versus private insurance.
I would love to say that Chris is incorrect in that, but he is absolutely correct. I think what we are seeing is that a lot of corporate entities that are accepting Badger Care are cropping up out of the woodwork, and they will not cover or essentially make crowns, partials, or anything happen for the patient because they will only do the procedures that they can get the money for. That is why free and charitable clinics like ours at HealthNet of Rock County can be a good resource for patients often, because we understand that quality of care discrepancy. However, that is based on how much we can fundraise to cover those costs that aren't covered by Badger Care. And that's dependent on certain clinics and their volume. But that is a huge problem. And it really comes down to the fact that many of the teeth that we are working with sometimes can't be saved as well, even if we try our hardest. And many of the situations that we're talking about often would be tens of thousands of dollars in private pay costs. So that discrepancy does exist, and Chris is correct. And it's still existing with COVID today.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris. We'll go now to Ben in Chippewa Falls. Ben, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have a comment about dental care. I've mostly not had great dental care my whole life, just basically being low income. But thankfully, right now, Wisconsin's economy and job market's doing so well. I'm able to afford my own dental care and medical care and vision. And things are going really great in that area. But also, I'm a person who, speaking to your next story, I can't take opioids. I had a terrible problem for many years getting off of them, and have been clean for 5 years now. So I'm also afraid of the pain. It will be expensive even with insurance. But the pain, yeah, that's going to be an issue too. And I thank you so much for talking about this stuff. It's very, very important. Thank you, Rob. Have a good day.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. So a couple issues there. Ben now can afford dental insurance, but because of he wasn't able to get that maintenance, that routine care over the years, it's going to add up to a lot. It's still going to be expensive. It sounds like out of pocket for him, Ian.
Yeah, Ben is actually in a very unique situation in which, by the way, I want to say thank you so much for sharing your story, especially around opiates. I think it's critically important for people to understand that the struggles with recovery are a lot harder than people know. That is a real situation. And if in the case you need an extraction, you can get sedated at an oral surgeon's office. However, that often requires that you have both medical and dental insurance in order to do that, to make it even somewhat affordable. And you're still paying hundreds of dollars out of pocket. So Ben, you is going through a very, very complex situation, but it's not too unique for a lot of individuals undergoing recovery. The good news, though, is that many dentists have found ways to not have the reliance on opiates be an issue after care, because they are prescribing fewer of them after care is done for extractions. So that, while that's not reducing pain necessarily, that is becoming a better part of the standard of care, and hopefully making it a easier proposition for somebody who's worried about struggling with addiction after a dental surgery.
Ben, best of luck as you get that dental treatment and through that recovery. We're talking about access to dental care here in the state. Ian Hedges is CEO of the free and charitable clinic HealthNet of Rock County. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a patient on Badger Care? Are there barriers for you in accessing, finding dental care? Do you think the state should do more to support patients who receive Badger Care via Medicaid? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Ian Hedges, CEO of HealthNet of Rock County, with us today to talk about the issues keeping low-income patients from dental care and what free and charitable clinics like his are doing to help. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, and maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I got a dog that's barking.
That's okay.
So I'll let her out.
Welcome to your dog, too, Richard.
No, my whole thing is I've been supporting dental care for a long time, and I go down to Mission McAllen, Texas, and I go over the border of Progreso, and there's a lot of buses that come down there from Snowbirds, and they get their dental work done for a tenth of the price.
So you're going, just to make that clear, Richard, you're going into Mexico to get your dental care.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's only like 20 steps.
Gotcha. Thank you for sharing that, Richard. I've heard of healthcare tourism. I guess dental tourism is a thing, Ian.
It is. And what I will tell you is the story is not uncommon not only among seniors, but also people within the 30 to 50-year-old age group when they're starting to realize that their teeth can decay and they're having some dental issues but don't have access to dental insurance. I've actually had a friend that has done the same thing because of the reduced cost. However, the issues do remain, though, that different countries have different standards of care. That also means, too, that one work that someone does in another country might be something that an American dentist is completely unfamiliar with. And even if it might be a good stopgap or even good care, it's still hard for an American dentist to possibly work around that issue that they tried to fix earlier on. And so that is unfortunately the system that we are experiencing right now. Probably what we do know is that in President Biden's social spending program agenda, he definitely, there was a push early on to have dental benefits for Medicare placed into that. That has now been taken out of to the final package. So it looks like for the time being, we are still stuck in this situation.
Richard, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Barbara joins us now in Montello. Barbara, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Barbara?
Well, you talked about opioids and the addiction problem. And Dr. Goldstein in California, she's been doing cannabis medicine for 25 years. And she says a dose of 4 milligrams of CBD with 4 milligrams of THC is a great pain reliever, better than opioids, and it's non-addictive.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Of course, THC, not an option here in Wisconsin, Ian, but are there alternative pain relief methods? You touched on a little bit of that earlier.
You know, I would say we are still kind of going down the Tylenol ibuprofen route. And I'm not sure if the standard of care has been fully established yet for THC and CBD using as a dental pain reliever aftercare. This is coming from myself, who actually worked for a state board that had to deal with medical marijuana. And we were struggling for a long time to figure out what that dosage necessary was for that, because the research and the body of evidence isn't totally out there yet.
Thanks for the call, Barbara. We are talking about access to dental care in Wisconsin, especially affordable dental care. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences or questions for our guest. Ian Hedges is with us, CEO of HealthNet of Rock County. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, I know some kinds of specialty health providers, I'm thinking mental health and addiction treatment here, can be few and far between. There are places in the state where you have to drive literally hours to access that. Do we have that kind of just geographical gap in dental coverage too?
We do, especially in northern Wisconsin. Not only are there few dentists accepting Medicaid, there are just fewer dentists overall. I will also tell you that some individuals have argued for different policy solutions, one of them being the dental Medicaid reimbursement being increased. There was actually a small pilot in Racine, Brown, and Polk counties done in 2015, and we saw that this higher reimbursement kicked in. One of the free and charitable clinics, Oral Health Partnership of Brown County, was able to actually see 8,000 more children on Medicaid who previously had no access to a dentist. However, that necessarily wasn't the case for counties that only had private providers available. And another policy solution that has been debated is dental therapy. Dental therapy would be a mid-level provider that takes some, it has more power than a hygienist, a little bit less than a dentist, and they would do some of that restorative work. It is a great way to delegate simpler dental procedures for the uninsured and underinsured. One of the few states that is doing dental therapy is Minnesota. And in the last 10 years, they have seen that as many as 90% of patients from uninsured or underinsured backgrounds were the patient base for dental therapists, which is great. But the Academy of General Dentistry actually did a study 2 years ago that saw that mid-level providers like dental therapists weren't covering the areas of need most because there's few of them. But they found that less than 25% of dental therapists practiced in areas outside of the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and only 8 out of the 42 dental therapists licensed in the state practice in areas with high professional shortage areas, which means areas with fewer dentists. And of course, dentists in rural areas don't have big sprawling clinics that can just add a staff member and capacity. So, you know, there is still a lot of work to do in terms of expanding that, those solutions for access.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rich is with us in Vilas County. Rich, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Rich?
Yeah, I was injured in a fire. I'm a volunteer firefighter at the time in 96 and went on Social Security disability. And I pretty much lived month to month, so I was never able to get the preventative care. And now I'm to the point where I need dentures, and to get the teeth removed and the dentures is $13,000, which just is an impossibility.
So what, have you seen any options for you out there, Rich, or is it just it's that or nothing?
That's pretty much all I've been able to find. I work with Marshfield Clinic Community Care Program there, and they told me if I didn't live in Vilas County, there were some programs out there, but because I'm in Vilas County, there is no such program.
Interesting. Rich, I'm sorry to hear that. Good luck. In somebody like Rich's situation, Ian, are there resources out there they could pursue?
They could. There are some places like Milwaukee. They could potentially go to the Marquette Dental School for further care. But the options are few for someone in Vilas County.
That's a haul.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Free and charitable clinics like myself, many of us have geographic restrictions, primarily because of our charitable focus. We rely a great deal on contributions, and if we didn't cap based on geographic reach, we might not get the concentration of donors to support our work, but we would have such an influx of individuals that we wouldn't be able to keep up care for many. And so, you know, Rich, I want to say that I am so sorry that you're in the situation you are in. You were clearly in a situation which you were, it sounds like you were saving lives, you were fighting fires. That's critically important. And I would suggest, looking at that option of the Marquette Dental School or any other dental school that you might know in a region outside of Wisconsin.
Rich, good luck getting that sorted out, pulling for you. Ian, in just our last few moments, anything else out there that's going to help this effort to provide better dental care just in our last half minute or so?
I would say please remember to donate to free and charitable clinics like HealthNet of Rock County, because they are doing critically important work. The clinics like mine are able to turn a dollar investment into $6.60 worth of care. And so we do stretch that dollar as much as we can. And we do that by getting donated dental supplies and volunteer dentists to help us out. I would also advocate that definitely, if you are a listener on the radio, be a resource for individuals who might be on Medicaid, because I will tell you, over the last 10 years, what I have learned is that so many people did not have access for so long that they stopped trying to get access. They were told no so many times. And so there now are more options out there. And if we know what those options are and are better.
I will have to leave it there. Thanks to Ian Hedges with HealthNet of Rock County. Coming up, a look at court rulings on opioid drug lawsuits. That's up next on Central Time.